Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
We're all looking for ways to save, especially on medical bills. But where do you start? Unless you're a medical billing expert, finding savings can seem impossible. HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your insurance and flags errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. Saving starts with knowing where to look. Visit HealthLock.com today before you see another healthcare provider.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Hello, this is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby. And I am your host, Liv, here with a very brief intro into a just a little bonus episode that we've put together for you today. And by we, I do mean I asked the wonderful Laura Smith, my audio engineer and production assistant, to scramble together a little bit of a recap episode, maybe. Basically, Laura has pulled together portions of two conversations that I aired last year about, I mean, not directly necessarily about Heterae, but featuring Heterae. And so these are some bits of those conversations which will essentially just help you to further understand the episode that I released this past Tuesday about Heterae in ancient Greece. And I just thought that they would be a great little accompaniment. And frankly, my computer crashed and I lost the introduction I'd already recorded, and now I've forgotten what I said. But it'll be a fun episode just featuring some further information about these really fascinating women from the ancient world. I just love the idea that we can talk about very real women and the lives they led, good or bad, and I'm so thrilled to be able to bring that to you. This is the bonus episode, selections from my conversations with Melissa Funke and Rebecca Futo Kennedy. The foreign women aspect, now that's all I can think about, you know, seeing the Amazons as this kind of like invading foreign women force.
Yeah, and that's one of the earliest. So in the, when they, you know, they didn't start rebuilding the Acropolis buildings until, they started commenced with the building of the Parthenon in 447. But right. there was a lot of building activity in Athens starting in the 460s, and it was sponsored by Cimon, who was the son of Miltiades, who was the general who led the day at Marathon, the Battle of Marathon. And one of the most famous buildings that he sponsored, his sister, Elpenike, who was the daughter of, so Cimon and Elpenike were both the children of Miltiades by a foreign woman, by a Thracian princess. And so they often had this, like Elpenike especially had this reputation for being a sort of big time party girl. And one of the other women who was well known as a big time party girl, even gets her own verb, is Corsaira, who was probably the daughter of Pisistratus. In Aristophanes's one of Aristophanes's plays, there's a character who's like he's referred to as being corsairified, meaning he like meaning he's like really like, you know, all into like showy luxury kind of things. But yeah, so he married Elpenike off. Miltiades dies in prison because he's in debt to the city, because the Athenians, they're never really kind to their successful generals because they're always worried that they're going to try and overthrow the democracy. So they're always sending them into exile or like something, right? So Miltiades dies in debtor's prison because he was charged 50 talents for a botched attempt to take a territory for them. And in order to pay it off, Cimon marries his sister off to like the wealthiest man in Athens, and they go on this building spree and sort of build all these buildings in the Agora. And one of the most famous is a building called the Stoa Poikile, the painted Stoa. It's famous because this is where the Stoics get their name. This is where they hung out. But it was famous because it was painted. It had these four paintings in the building. And then later, which I'll describe the painting in a second so you can see how this sort of works out. But then later, during the Peloponnesian War, it was this building where, when the Athenians defeated and captured a group of over 200 Spartans at the island of Sphacteria in 425, they took their shields as, you know, trophies, and they hung them on this building.
Wow.
And we have one. It's in the Agora Museum. It's very cool.
Yeah.
So the building had four paintings in it. Two were mythical, two were historical. The first one is, and I can't remember the exact order of them, but they're sort of paired up. But the first one is the invasion of the Amazons, right? Which has Theseus and Heracles sort of fighting the Amazons. Next to it is the Battle of Marathon. And one of the things that's very interesting is that the descriptions of the painting that we have from Pausanias, who saw the paintings, describes the Persians and the Amazons as both wearing like leopard print. You know, the sort of, they're given the same sort of outfits, right? Mm-hmm. And you see this also on vase paintings. And so a lot of scholars have argued, art historians have argued, that we should see the Amazon stories as an analog for the Persian Wars, which I think is you know, fine. But one of the things that's interesting about the Marathon battle is it shows the sort of protective gods and spirits sort of popping up in the corner. And so Athena, of course, pops up, and Theseus pops up. Miltiades and Cimon claim to be descended from Theseus, which is another tie in here, which I'll explain another story in a second. But Theseus pops up, you know, Pan is there, and they're sort of all in the background. And that's the painting right next to the Battle of the Amazon Anarchy. Then next to that is the Sack of Troy, which you would think is a really weird thing to put on this building, but it also, of course, shows up on the Parthenon. But the Sack of Troy shows up. But the way it's described gives you an insight as to why it is on an Athenian monument to Athenians. In the center of the painting, and again, the Trojans are described as wearing these like leopard print outfits, sort of like the New Jersey housewives sort of tracksuit with a Scythian hat. And they are... So again, we have Trojan War as analogy, becomes in this period analogy for Persian wars.
Yeah.
And when the Trojans finally become Persianified, right? Instead of being Greek, as they appear in the Homer. But the thing in the center shows the judgment of a guy named Little Ajax, or Ajax Locris.
Right.
So he's the guy who raped Cassandra on the altar of Zeus.
Right.
And it shows a trial for him, according to Pausanias.
Yeah.
And there's also a play by Sophocles that's that was put on around the same time as this building went up, called the Ajax Locris, which has as its central feature a trial scene of Ajax Locris. And the people who, the two people shown leading the trial are the two sons of Theseus, who are inserted into the catalog of ships as having been at the Battle of, the Battle of Troy. So Cymon, so what's happening simultaneously is one of the things of Cymon's claim to fame is that he, because people don't remember that Theseus got banished at the end of his life. This is why he's living in Troezen with Hippolyta, with Phaedra and his son Hippolytus. He was kicked out because he killed the 50 sons of Pallas. But he had gone to the island of Scyros, where he ended up being buried after his death. And Cymon goes and reclaims his bones and brings them back and reburies them in Athens, right? He finds a supersized skeleton and brings it back because this is the only way they can, like, you know, gain victory in a war, you know, of some battle of some sort. And so, but he does so also by laying claim to the, his relationship. So we have these three paintings and they're all painted by, they're painted by different people, but one of them, the Troy, is painted by a painter, a famous painter named Polygnotus, who is also very famous for his vase paintings of Amazonomachies and things. He's also good friends with Sophocles, the playwright, who put this play together. And they're all good friends with Pericles. But Polygnotus was also suggested that he had an affair with Elpenike, Cymon's sister.
There's so much happening. I love it so much.
So, you know, it's like the, you know, the, you know, what is it? The Real Housewives, the real, you know, of Athens kind of
just
thing.
Just like the but best all gossip. Stuff,
but these are all the movers and shakers who are passing the laws, funding the buildings that are presenting these new mythologies and embedding them within the Athenian imagination and literally into the landscape by putting them on buildings in the landscape. So you have all this stuff sort of going on where all of a sudden Amazons and the Trojan War all become analogies for the Persian Wars. And then you have these very specific stories that elevate the Athenians in these contexts long before the Athenians were ever considered a major player on the Greek stage, right?
The Amazonomachy, we've talked like a little bit about that. I know it was like an enormous iconographic setting or, you know, however you want to, however I should phrase that, but like, you know, that it kind of appeared on everything. And so like, I don't know what quite what I'm asking, but basically it seems to me that there was like a level of respect for the Amazonomachy, for the Amazons generally, but then still always depicting them as being both defeated by Athens and also this, like, you know, the foreign aspect. So yeah, I mean, is it always kind of dangerous. Connecting them to Persia or
No. So Andy Stewart, who a great art historian who recently just passed away, I loved him. He's a wonderful human being. But he wrote an article back. He was sort of one of the big experts on Koroi and Kore statues, the sort of maiden statues, but also Athenian red figure painting and pottery and sculpture. And he wrote an article, gosh, it might even have been in the 90s, but definitely early 2000s at the latest, on vase representations of the Amazons and the Amazonomachy. And one of the things that he, so what he basically argued, and once you see it, you can't unsee it, you see it on every vase. Like, the Amazons are represented in two ways. One, they're represented simultaneously as foreign invaders, right? They've got like the Scythian cap on and they've got animal print leggings and everything. But over top of those animal print leggings and the animal print or like fancy designed leotard is the chiton of a Parthenos, which is the pre-married, unmarried girl who is available for marriage. Like, this is the coming of age girl. And his argument was that they are simultaneously figures of fear and danger, but also desire. And so I saw a vase painting in the Vatican Museum, which he had never seen, but I think it guarantees his interpretation in some ways, because it's not just that they're wearing the guises of the Parthenoi, Sometimes they have the leopard prints and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they just have the chiton on, but that marks them as desirable, right? Mm-hmm. But in this particular vase, it's got a Greek warrior running in one direction, and he's looking backwards, and it's got an Amazon following him, chasing him, and she's looking at him as well. And it is what we call a kalos vase. So someone used this vase as a gift for someone that they thought was beautiful and that they were in love with. Oh. But the vase has kalos over the male figure and kale over the Amazon. So here you have a Greek Amazon sort of erotically charged love scene. Like they're in the middle of a battle against each other, but they're gazing at each other with desire. And this is recognized by whoever owned this pot because they chose to gift this pot as a sign of erotic affection to a beloved. So I think that there's something about, you know, and I think this is where Hippolytus as a mythological figure stands at this focus, because the thing that is wrong with Hippolytus is his rejection of eroticism and physical love entirely. He says, I have the heart of a Parthenos in his speech. He doesn't say that he hates women. He says, I have the heart of a Parthenos. And that's going to read weird to anybody in an Athenian audience, right? But that's representing one of the desirable figures about the Amazon, because he's a male Amazon, right? He's just an Amazon in a man's body.
Yeah.
He's a Parthenos, which makes him eligible for and should be desired for marriage, but he rejects it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so, but I think this is what the Amazon is such an interesting figure for them, is that it's not that they're an analogy necessarily for the Persian war itself. They can be used that way, but that they also, because of the gender aspect of the Amazons and what they represent, they are the sort of a locus of anxiety about a tension between fear and desire. But they're a danger, a threat to the very fabric of how Athenian life is, social life is structured. But that in some ways makes them want them.
Yeah, makes them so interesting. I mean, I imagine there's got to be some kind of inherent tie there too, to the fact that they are women warriors, right? Like the fear of a woman in that role.
Probably. I mean, this is one of the things that makes them, like, they reject men. They reject marriage. They reject the inside and they live in the outside.
Yeah, it's like everything Athenian women can't do.
Right. The ideals for the Athenian woman are like they're the opposite. But at the same time, they embody this one element of the desired pre-wife. Right. They're sexually appealing.
I love that you've not said the word virgin once, by the way. I appreciate that. The pre-wife is such a good way of describing that.
Well, because the word Parthen, so this is a problem, right? A woman, as far as we can tell in our sources, a woman doesn't become a wife officially until she gives birth to her first child.
Really? The actual birth?
I mean, that's the word, yes. So that's what stops you from, it's not having sex. That's not what makes you not a Parthenos. It's having a child. If you sort of do a deep dive into the actual uses of the words in their connotations.
That's
for
great.
Women, the dividing line between between Parthenos and Gune is childbirth. It's not marriage itself.
It's not sex.
It's not sex.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've like over the course of the podcast, I've changed how I phrase things based on, because nine times out of ten you read and in a translation it's going to say the word virgin, like almost always, right?
Yeah, it's wrong. I mean, but it's only wrong if you conceptualize virgin in the way that Christianity conceptualizes virgin.
Well, exactly.
If you sort of, right, if you rethink the fact, like the Greeks actually have we have evidence that virginity was renewable. Like it wasn't once something you lost and done. Like you could like not have sex for 6 months and then you are ritually pure again to be a priestess for a cult, and so you're a virgin again. right? It's like there are ways around that rule. And Sharon James wrote a really short sort of little study of a poem by Archilochus in this like mass, it's like this massive 600 page companion to women in the ancient world. And she writes this like little 3-page analysis of this little, it's a fragmented poem by Archilochus in which he seduces the sister of like the woman who rejected him or something like that. I can't remember the whole story, but it's basically evidence that premarital sex was not out with respectable women, like, right?
Right.
Like that premarital sex wasn't the thing. Like as long as you didn't get pregnant, It's like her argument is like, this is evidence that having sex before marriage was not the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I mean, it makes sense too, in relation to like all the mythological stories of, but at the same time, it's like anytime that like it needs to kind of serve a purpose where a god, you know, has sex with a mortal woman, like there's always going to be a child because
they have like, super sperm.
Yeah. Well, yes, of course. Exactly. They get to do what they want with it. But that's, yeah, it's interesting to, I mean, I'm fascinated now by the giving birth aspect. Cause I said, I've kind of shifted my own phrasing to say unmarried and to clarify, you know, that when you see the word virgin, it doesn't mean what we think today. It means unmarried. But now knowing that it's more about like when the actual birth takes place is even more fascinating. Yeah. That feels like a very late moment.
Yeah, there's actually quite a few good articles on this. I did a
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
I wrote a book review of the new Greek lexicon. because that's what we do. We review dictionaries. but they commissioned two different reviews. So one of the reviewers did a sort of general look at the sort of language of the dictionary. And I did a look specifically at the language of race and ethnicity and of gender and women, because this was one of the big things that the writers of the dictionary were really super interested in doing, is updating the language around women and gender and sexuality, because, you know, that 19th century Victorian dictionary is so out of touch with, you know, they basically turned the ancient Greeks into Victorians with the way they translated these terms. And that's where that term virgin is in there. If you look at the sort of newer Greek dictionary, the new Cambridge lexicon of the Greek language, like, they're much more nuanced in understanding how the word Parthenos, you know, or the word Gune or Palake, all sort of all these different Hetaira, which everyone also translates as courtesan, but there are actually six different uses of the term. Palake actually has like four different uses, one of which is just means a temple attendant. It doesn't have anything to do with their relationship to men. So, you know, when you actually do deep dives into the usages and you're not being shaded by your sort of Victorian morality, you realize that these terms have a lot more nuance. And they don't fit cleanly into our assumptions about how we want to rebuild the ancient Greeks in our image.
Yeah. I love that. I mean, I still, and I brought this up recently in another conversation, when I learned that heteros is often translated as companion or like comrade.
Well, that's, heteros, right? Is your drinking buddies.
Yeah. And then
hetaira is a whore, you know, is a high class one.
So
I wrote an article on this because the criteria that people use to classify what is and isn't a hetaira, and this goes back to an article by Leslie Kirk, who was like, hetaira are courtesans. They get gifts. They don't get paid for sex. They get gifts. And a porne is someone who gets paid money for sex, right? That's very narrow. There are these women, they do exist, right? But there's no sort of grand horizontale demimonde hetaira, you know, grand courtesans in 5th century Athens. But women like Elpenike, who I mentioned earlier, Kaimon's sister, she is probably someone who would have been called a hetaira in her own time period, but not as a courtesan. She's known to be a citizen. She's known to be a wife of like the wealthiest Callias, the wealthiest man in Athens. But she's a party girl. I mean, we have all these vases from antiquity that show women at symposia, some of them just women together. And we know that there were women only symposia. They're not called symposia. They're called a penitus. But my argument in the article was that when we see this term used in the context of a symposium, we have to be careful, because it may in fact be that what we're talking about are these wealthy Athenian women who are hanging out together and having parties with each other in the same way that their hetairoi, the male guys, are getting together and having parties together. And that this is like Corsaira, you know, this wealthy woman who was known for partying and known for luxury. And these are publicly known figures. These are not women who weren't named. These women were named in very public spaces and shamed. There was a rumor that Elpenike and her brother Kaimon were having an incestuous relationship that was circulating. She was accused of having an affair with Polynotus the painter. But my funnest piece of evidence for Elpenike and for Corsaira both is that the Athenians had this thing that I also refer to as the anti-election, right? So every few years, you would have an election every year if you get a quorum. To ostracize, to kick somebody out of the city. So you ostracize and you kick them out for 10 years. They don't lose their citizenship. They don't lose their property, or they just have to move out for 10 years and they're not allowed back in the city. And normally you would do this if you think somebody's like getting, they're aiming at tyranny. It's an anti-tyranny law.
Right.
But it was often just used by politicians. Like, we know the last ostracism to take place was like, Alcibiades and Nicias were both up to be ostracized, and they got together and colluded to make sure a third person that wasn't either of them got ostracized, and the dude, innocent guy who did nothing, right? And the Athenians were like, okay, this has like been corrupted, like we can't use this anymore.
Right? Alcibiades, that makes sense. That checks out.
Yeah, totally, right? Totally Alcibiades thing. But Kaimon gets ostracized, and so does a guy named Megacles, who's the son of Corsaira. And on the ostracon, we have ostracon, which are the broken pieces of pottery after which the process is named, where you carve the name of the person you want to kick out. And so Megacles has Megacles and has the father's name and has son of Corsaira. Like, you don't put the mother's name on there unless the mother's name carries a negative value for you, right? Megacles is a guy who, while he was off in ostracism land, he went and won the Olympic chariot race. Like, he's like, I don't give a fuck. Like, kick me out of the city. I've got so much money. I don't care. I can go wherever I want. He was totally living his best life. Chimon, you know, the one that from Chiron, it says, Chimon, son of Miltiades, take your sister. Yeah. Labon Elpenikane Ito. Taking Elpenike, go. Get out. And it uses Ito, the duel. Yeah. So she's again named and shamed. It's like, everybody knows who Chimon is. Take your sister and get the hell out of the city.
Yeah.
Like, so these are the women who I think that are the originating words for the sort of negative use of this term, hetaira.
Yeah.
These are party girls. And so when you see later in the fourth century, these women who are sort of not available for marriage, often because they're foreign women,
right.
So they can't, you know, in the fourth century, you know, after 451, the children, if you marry a foreign woman, they can't become a citizen. There are still reasons to marry foreign women because you maybe have citizen children from your first marriage. And so you don't want any more citizen children. Because you have to divide the property equally.
Yeah.
So the property will just keep getting smaller and smaller every generation. When they ban marriage finally in the fourth century, you know, these foreign women are completely ineligible for marriage. But they're getting paid to come to parties and, you know, things like this. So, but those negative connotations, I think, actually root back to these like really famous, wealthy, don't give a fuck party girls. They're like the Kardashians of their generation.
Yeah.
I always think like Paris Hilton, you know, in sort of her heyday.
I was just going to age myself by, suggesting Paris Hilton in like the 2000s.
Yeah. Right. Like that's sort of, you know. And is that these are, and they were, you know, they were in all the tab. If we had legal speeches from that period, we know that like friends of Pericles were charged with heresy, with sacrileges. And Aspasia was supposedly one of these people. Well, Aspasia is a wealthy foreign woman who is probably married to Pericles. Her sister was married to, you know, Alcibiades the Elder. She's not a prostitute. She's living in Pericles' home. She's not running a brothel out of Pericles' home. Like, these are just stories that we tell to demonize these women because they don't fit into our boxes. I actually just wrote the new Ancient History Encyclopedia entry on Aspasia and, you know, pulled in all the evidence to show that this, like, calling this woman a courtesan is or a madam is just absolutely historically inaccurate, and you need to stop people. But she's part of this sort of mythos of these sort of wealthy elite women who were sort of functioning. They were companions of each other. I mean, Sappho, that's how Sappho talks about, she uses the word hetaira to talk about her girlfriends that she hangs out with.
I mean, it makes sense. I just can't.
So when you brought that up, it just like hits one of my pet peeves about bad scholarship. And
no, I'm thrilled to hear all of that. I mean, it's amazing. Like, so actually just last week, I also recorded with Melissa Funke, who's just written.
Oh yeah, I love Melissa.
She's wonderful. And she's got this book coming out about Phryne. And so like a lot of this is like connecting right into that conversation. Because...
Yeah, I actually argued in my Immigrant Women book, I have a little tiny bit on Phryne because she shows up in these, you know, courtroom discourses. I argued that Phryne was not actually prosecuted. You know, she was prosecuted because of her relationship with an Athenian man, because she had crossed the boundary that she shouldn't have crossed in this period. But she probably actually, based on the evidence we have, I think she was actually very much integrated into sort of upper class society as the priestess of a foreign cult.
Interesting.
We have evidence that she's told, she was accused in numerous documents, she's accused of bringing foreign gods into the city. And one of the things that she was, the sacrilege trial that she was put on trial for was for worshiping a foreign god. Like, but she's hanging out with like all the people that she's, that are in this, this context are all wealthy citizens. So she crossed the citizen foreigner boundary in a way that she shouldn't have, but she is not a prostitute. You know, it's like, it just doesn't make sense, but she probably was associated in some ways with parties and, you know, the wealthy life and potentially with foreign cult. But a lot of foreigners living in Athens, particularly in Piraeus, are associated with foreign cults, because foreign cults all had the ISIS cult, Magna Mater. There's so many foreign gods that were brought in to Athens through the port. Mm-hmm. So a lot of them were priestesses. We have all these tombstones for priestesses of foreign cults.
It's Phryne? Is that right? Or
okay. Yes. So this is actually a bone of contention.
Great. Let's start there.
Okay, sure. I have always called her Phryne. Because of the way that people in North America tend to anglicize certain sounds in or from Greek, but Brits call her Phryne, and I suspect Australians too. And so I have had British people like be very scandalized. They're like, surely you mean Phryne. And, I mean, you know, I call her Phryne. I've heard other people call her Phryne. We're not using ancient Greek here too, right? So like Phryne is no more accurate than Phryne for Phryne. So,
right.
You know, I call her Phryne, but I suspect there will be some Brits going, oh my God, what is she doing to this poor name?
You know what? I mean, I prefer it that way. I swear, I mean, so many times I'll hear British people pronounce names and it's like they're going with a Shakespearean version. And it so often sounds too much like that to me that I'm like, I kind of prefer almost the North American versions of saying a lot of the names. I certainly do that too. I've had conversations where I'm like, we're just pronouncing it two different ways throughout, and it is what it is.
Yes. I mean, I have moments all the time where I'm like, how do I want to say this name? Do I want, like, should a kappa be a C, like a soft C in English? But I do it enough, and I tend to pick when I'm teaching what my students are most likely to hear. So
yeah, I certainly mix it, especially when it comes to the K. Like, yeah, it's very tough to decide with that one.
Yeah, but you know, it's not a living language in the same way. So if I were speaking someone's name, for example, obviously I'm not going to be like, nah, it's coming out the way I'm saying it. You know, obviously I would never do that to a person who is alive. I feel like Phryne can handle it if my pronunciation of her name is like the least distorted aspect of her that has made it to 2023. So
well, that leads to the perfect way of like the way I kind of wanted to start this, which is just that so her story, I feel like, unlike most things from ancient Greece, has become like a meme that goes around fairly often of just like that one moment. I won't spoil it all, but that one moment that she seems to be so famous for. And that is all that I know about her. So I really want to hear everything, not least because she's a real ancient woman. So just, please tell me everything.
So because it's summer break, I've been kind of, you know, spending time on social media. And I was like, okay, I'm going to just look up on TikTok. Like, what do you get for Phryne on TikTok? And oh, you're God. Right. She is a meme. The first thing you get is, oh, she's this woman who flashed her way to freedom, I think is one of the headlines that I've seen, but who like was naked in front of people, right? Mm-hmm. And in a way, like that is true. Like she, describing her as a meme is not incorrect. Like she's an ancient meme, basically, this woman. And so all the stories of her are just various memes that have become compiled in all of these different ways. But there is a real woman at the heart of all this. Mm-hmm. And we can't quite discover her. And that's something that you have to accept with a woman like Phryne, a figure like Phryne, because of the way her stories and details about her have been recorded, is that we're never going to like dig down to who is the real Phryne. We might as well hope to find the real Helen of Troy, right? There's no chance. But if we kind of look at the collected stories, that's where we start to get an image of what possibilities there were for a woman like her. So Phryne, the story that we are alluding to here, by the way, is the story of her trial, right? So she went on trial in 4th century Athens for impiety. And just when it seemed like she was about to be convicted, and it was possible in this kind of a case that it could have been a capital trial, right? She could have been, at risk of being put to death. And there are different stories. In one of the stories, one of the versions, she reveals herself. In the other one, the fellow who is representing her, Hyperides, basically her lawyer in the courtroom, he whips off her dress. Mm. And she's, of course, so outrageously beautiful that all the men, and of course the jury is composed of Athenian citizen men, of course we're all sitting there, go, oh my God, she's so beautiful. And in some of the sources they say it's almost like they're struck with religious awe, like they're looking at Aphrodite almost, right? And that this sense of this beauty, right, causes them to acquit her. So this is probably the most famous story about her of the many that are told. But the two most famous stories about her involve nudity. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing about Frinny. She is famously, you know, one of the most beautiful women, or at least most attractive women. And she is periodically naked in very prominent settings in public. So the other story about Frinny that is often told, and this, there's only one ancient source that actually really makes this connection directly, but is that she is the model for the Aphrodite of Cnidos.
Right.
So, yeah. So for those who aren't familiar with this statue, you've seen images of it for sure, even if you don't know what it's called. It's known as the first monumental female nude. So the first mm-hmm. nude female statue that is sort of life size or bigger. Right. So there's other nude images on vase paintings, on carved friezes and things, but not these statues that would be put into a temple. Right. Mm-hmm. So there's this very famous statue. People will be familiar probably with the image of Botticelli's Birth of Venus, right? That is mm-hmm. that pose is based on the Aphrodite of Cnidos. So the story, the one source that we have from Athenaeus, this late Roman author from Egypt, right? He says that that Phryne, she was again well known in 4th century Athens. She's a sex worker. We haven't even touched on that yet, but she's a very famous, exclusive sex worker. And she goes to a festival down by the sea. And it seems to be a festival down in Eleusis, which is sort of in northern Attica. And she's down by the sea and she goes and bathes in the sea. And as she emerges nude before this crowd, everyone again is kind of struck with awe. And there happen to be a couple of the most famous artists of classical Greece there. Praxiteles, the sculptor, who sculpts the Aphrodite of Cnidos, and Apelles, who is the painter who paints the Aphrodite. It's called Aphrodite Anadyomene, so rising from the sea, basically. Mm. And again, that's a very famous pose we'd be kind of familiar with, where it's a nude woman rising out of the sea. And she's, of course, I'm doing the actions for this and we're on a podcast, but she's sort of wringing out her hair on either side of her head. So it's a very famous pose. I'm going to end up talking about that pose probably later anyways. Of course, you know, these two most famous visual artists who have probably the most impact on visual art, on sculpture, on painting in ancient Greece, just happened to be there to see this famously beautiful woman emerging, right? So, her fame is largely centered on sort of appearing naked in public at just the right time.
I mean, I love that for her. Like, what a way to leave a memory, but also especially when it comes to ancient Athens, because like, we don't know a lot of real women who did things that could get them that famous, and that's fun.
Who are the women whose names we know? A student once asked me this. I was teaching a class on 4th century Athens, and he was like, can you name a woman? What are the named women? And so I said Phryne, and then I said Lice, and then I just was naming all sex workers,
right?
Which is fine. It's good. It's okay to know both sex workers, but I couldn't name just regular sort of everyday citizen women or enslaved women, certainly. And if I was an epigrapher, if I studied inscriptions, I'd probably know a few from gravestones and things like that. But in terms of the ones that I know offhand, I know a little bit about their lives. I know a little bit about their identities. That's it, right? Is mostly sex workers.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking Aspasia is the other one that I couldn't think of. Yeah. Is she 4th or 5th? But like, I mean, there's not a lot.
And yeah, she's 5th century. Yeah.
Right.
But
she's also,
she gets
sex
called
worker,
a sex worker. She gets called a sex worker.
Okay. Yeah.
She is not likely to have been a sex worker, but she's a woman in public. So why not call her a sex worker anyways?
Athens, that's how they, that, of course, that's what they were.
I mean, there are some people who have suggested even that women like Phryne, and so the term that I would apply to her is hetaira, which it just literally means female companion.
That it just means companion blew my mind, because the way that it is used interchangeably with sex worker all of the time.
Yeah.
And then I saw it used in relation to Patroclus, and I was like, I'm sorry, it just means companion. And like, when we're translating it about men, we're saying comrade. And when we're translating about women, we're saying often straight whore. And you're like, okay, the word is the same. Really, that's what we're doing. So yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, in the way that I think that we would also use euphemisms today, if I was like, oh, I saw so-and-so and he had a companion, wink, wink, you know, it's that kind of thing. But then you get this slippage where you can apply it to women who are in public with men, right? Mm-hmm. Who are not their husbands. And so then it's like, are they sex workers? Are they just women who are not doing what you expected or want them to do? Mm-hmm. So, and even in fourth century Athens, especially in the legal trials, right? Because quite a few of the sex workers end up on trial, right? Think about Neaira is a good example of this. And there's a very clever way that the speakers use the term hetaira, because they're kind of suggesting, oh, companion, wink, wink, the kind of woman that you would give gifts to, wink, wink. And then, you know, in Against Neaira, for example, the speaker towards the end, he's like, actually, she's a porne. She's a just a regular old prostitute. So you see, even then, they're really aware that there is slippage in this term. So yes, you're right. Like in the modern world, we can't just assume if someone calls someone a sex worker that they are a sex worker, right? I mean, the same is true in the modern world too.
Well, and it's just so interesting to have that differentiation, because I think, like, I'm just thinking of translations, because that's what I come across most.
Yeah. But
so often you get hetera, like when it's about a woman, translated in these like really derogatory ways, when it, I mean, it does just mean companion. But also, like you said, there's the differentiation between a hetera and a porne, which is like, what, like ones like I tend to call them like fancy sex workers on my show, like when I'm referring to that exact type, like, you know, more like an escort versus, you know, a more, you know, the porno being like more traditional kind of, I guess, street style sex workers. But so often in translations, it is just like straight whore or something. And it just makes me think of, I mean, just the way things have been translated for us and how that's impacted everything. But
yes, that, I mean, that's a really big problem, right? Like with the hetaira in particular, it's a huge problem. Yeah. But yeah, there's a real like slippage between the terms. And definitely like we can't as scholars go, oh, okay, well you, like we don't have the receipts to go, oh, well you charge by the hour. So you're a porne. Oh, did you accept a really expensive necklace? Obviously you're a hetaira. Like there's going to be some major slippage there. And even when it comes to like sex work, how do we determine like what actually is a sex worker? Because the hetairai, it seems we're sometimes brought into people's houses for like long-term relationships. Is that sex work? In my books, it kind of is, right? Or like there are enslaved people in houses who are basically doing sexual labor, but they're not really like, maybe they're not sex workers because that's not how they make a living. Like there's so much slippage there with sexual labor as a whole. And then the terms we use, because they're so often meant to be derogatory, it's really hard to, you know, to know. And then you make a bunch of assumptions too about, again, women in public, women in the wrong place. And tickety boo, we have some misogyny there, right?
Yeah.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you.
24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to think, I'm covered, no worries. Well, not so fast. Remember, your out-of-pocket costs are not covered by insurance. That can be a lot of money for your family. But how do you know you're not being overbilled? It's estimated that over 50% of medical bills contain errors. Unless you're a billing expert, how do you know your medical bills are accurate? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your insurance. When your medical claims come in, HealthLock technology reviews the claim for errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. HealthLock makes it easy to find and fix hidden errors, so you pay only what you owe. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To date, HealthLock has helped its members save over $130 million. Bottom line, insurance alone isn't enough. To save, visit HealthLock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider. That's HealthLock.com.
Yeah. I mean, this comes up. I've spoken to Elodie Harper, who wrote The Wolf Den a few times. And I remember like that she was so specific in how she was talking about it, because in at least in the first book, like the character is in the actual like the wolf den, the brothel in Pompeii. And so she made a point of using the word prostitute. She was like, she was being prostituted by somebody else. Like there's a difference there between the kind of empowerment that often can come with the term sex worker. And it, I mean, especially in those cases, like the difference is important to kind of clarify, because it, I mean, it just all about agency and everything.
Yeah. And I genuinely suspect that a woman like Frinny, who ended up becoming so famous and so prominent, her beginnings were probably not very pleasant. Again, I'm not going to guarantee anything about this, but you know, the odds are not impossible that she was probably enslaved as a child. And we know, again, from speeches like Against Neaira, that women were brought into the sex trade enslaved very often, and often very young. Like the speaker who's talking about Neaira says she was basically too young. She wasn't mature enough when she started in sex work, right? It's dire.
Yeah. If Athenians think you're too young, like then, then it's really too young.
Exactly. By like 2023 standards, right?
Yeah, God.
So, you know, It's very easy to be like, oh, she was this beautiful woman who like showed up on the seaside and was, you know, inspired these artists. But when you really think about the power dynamics that were at play, probably for most of her life, even once she became, and I think it's very likely that she did become very wealthy at some point, there's still the way that Athenian society is set up in particular. You know, anyone can grab her and pop her into court. And she's got to stand there before a bunch of Athenian citizen men and hope that they're not going to put her to death or do something terrible to her. So I think it's very easy when we look at these stories of the Hetairai to get sort of swept up into the, you know, the glamour of it. But there's like a really non-glamorous core there that we have to like keep in mind all the time. Yeah.
So if she was on trial for impiety, like, do we know what that looked like? Do we know what she did or what they said she did?
Oh, that's a great question. Okay. So she is, one of our sources mentions that she's accused of introducing new gods, which is also the same for Socrates. It's basically the same charges that Socrates got charged with.
That's fascinating.
And I, you know, thinking about Frinny, I was like, okay, Frinny's actually kind of, in a sense, she's like a parallel to Socrates. And so it's not uncommon to put philosophers and Hetairai together, So like the later Roman authors have a blast. They make jokes about it all the time, about how silly it is to kind of pair these two. And they always have like the hetairai are sort of more clever than the philosophers half the time. They're getting the best of these famous men. But they're all people who are like trying to spend time with wealthy, typically younger Athenian men from elite families. And they're like making some money off of this too. Mm-hmm. Socrates less so, but they are getting something from this relationship. Mm-hmm. And, but again, ultimately that power still rests with those elite young men in a way, even though it doesn't seem that way. And so they're vulnerable if public opinion turns, if those men turn on them, they're in big trouble, which is, it's not quite that the young men that were following Socrates turned on him, but enough public sentiment did, right? And there he was up on trial. And so Phryne is the same. The suggestion is that the fellow who brought her to court, a fellow named Euthyas, had been her lover previously and brought her to court. And then the fellow, of course, who defends her, Hyperides, is like a famous patron of sex workers. He's apparently got like two or three on the go in different households around Attica when he steps up to defend Phryne. Again, like these all come from different sources. So I think, you know, much of it we have to really think about a little bit more critically. But these are the stories that are told about her. So yeah, she goes up for trial for impiety, basically. She's been having gatherings in the Lyceum. And of course, the Lyceum is where Aristotle's school is, right? Mm-hmm. Like that further connection to our philosophers. She's introduced a new god. The name of the god in one of the sources is Isodites, who is like a sort of connected to Dionysus, right? So she's doing things that are making people uncomfortable, I think, is the moral of that story. But the punishment in these court cases is not fixed. So what happens in first century Athens when these charges are brought, you have a sort of the main trial to see if you're guilty or not. And then you have a second sort of mini trial over what the punishment will be. So you can propose. It's the same thing that happens to Socrates, actually. If anyone's ever read Socrates' Apology, it's the exact same thing where he gets to propose a sort of an easier punishment for himself. Anyways, and so, but the concern is that she could be put to death over this. And again, that moment of revelation is what saves her and saves her life.
Yeah. Just the idea that she was too hot for them to kill. Like, that's pretty great.
That's it right there.
But yeah, so I mean, I realize I should have started this with the note, but I will in my introduction anyway. But you've written a book on her. So that, I mean, one, that's so cool. And obviously that's why we're talking, but like, how much do we know? We know a book's worth about this woman?
Well, okay. Like, so I
do, certainly.
Well, I have done, but also there's that like speculation using evidence of other similar figures where you're like, okay, there is this court case about Neaera that is one of our most fulsome sources about the life of any woman in the fourth century. Even though it's written from the perspective of someone who is obviously trying to slander her and, you know, depict her as this horrible person, but it actually gives us a lot of insight into like what the life of a sex worker might have been like. So I'm not saying that Phryne and Neaera are the same, but they lived at the same time, right? The trial of Neaera happened in the 340s when Phryne was pretty active in Athens. So we can kind of go, okay, they were kind of peers in a way, right? They have something in common. And so whether Phryne's story is identical or just shares elements, people like Neaera and those stories give us this space to kind of speculate in a generative way, which is what we're always doing with Phryne, because all of her stories are fragments, right? That fragments make you fill in the blanks. So anytime we encounter her, so what are the stories about Phryne? Like what do we know? Mm-hmm. Okay, we know her, Phryne's a nickname. It means toad. Because her complexion was so pale. And I'm always trying to figure out, like, what is toad like about a woman's appearance?
Especially when one not, is famously beautiful. Like, she's famous for being hot, but her name means toad. Like, okay, there's a lot happening.
I know.
There.
I mean, it's kind of like when you call a tall guy shorty, you know?
Right.
It's kind of like that, maybe. Yeah. But I'm not going to lie, when I was researching this book, I did look at a lot of pictures of toads just to kind of explore how that metaphor might be working. But yeah, so we know that her original name was Mnesarete, which means like sort of recalling virtue. And she was, or excellence, I suppose. She was from Thespiae or connected to Thespiae. Thespiae is in Boeotia, which is north of Attica. So she's from Thespiae, or she has a connection. So some people have suggested her family lived in Athens as resident foreigners. And you would never be an Athenian if you're a resident mm-hmm. foreigner. You could never, no matter how long or how many generations in the fourth century, it was impossible basically to become an Athenian. So, but I think she probably came to Athens, possibly as a refugee. Thespiae was destroyed by the Thebans, I think in 371-ish. You know, there's lots of ways that she could have ended up in Athens, but she definitely associated with this town, Thespiae. Okay, so, you know, what's the deal with Thespiae? Well, Thespiae is famous for its massive sanctuary to the god Eros. And what's the god, you know, Eros the god of? Sexy love is how I always translate it for my students. Like desire, right? Sexual desire. So you've got the hottest sex worker of the fourth century, and she's from the same hometown as, like, sexy love. This is all really perfect and ideal. But I do think she really was connected. You know, if we want to say, okay, there's a real Phryne somewhere in these stories, I do think she's really connected to Thespiae. There were statues of her there historically that we know about. There's a coin that references this statue. So at some point, the statue was there. It was, of course, like a lot of famous statues taken out and moved around by the Romans. But it was there.
But a statue of a real woman, like a sex worker, ended up actually on display. That's incredible.
On display in a sanctuary. Yeah. And it's a sanctuary to Eros. So, and apparently it was part of a trio. So Eros, Aphrodite, and Aphrodite, of course, who she's associated with through Praxiteles, but in this like very minor way. But yes, so Aphrodite, Praxiteles, and Eros all together in this trio, which is incredible. Great. There was also a statue of her, a gilded statue at Delphi. That was up with a Spartan king, and I want to say a famous Theban general. But, you know, and it was of her, and it wasn't like her posing as someone. It was her as herself. And so, you know, you hear there are different anecdotes where people walk in and they're, you know, they look at it and they're shocked. Who would put a statue of a sex worker in this, you know, in Delphi, right? But, you know, she's prominent enough, no matter what, she's prominent enough for it to be accepted that you could find a statue of her in these places.
Yeah.
Which, you know, just says a lot about her profile. Oh, it's so cool. Yeah. It's so cool.
It's so cool. That just makes me so happy.
And so, like, a lot of the writers who think about Phryne, they're really obsessed with these images of her and this connection to Praxiteles. So there's lots of poems, epigrams, so the kind of poem that you would inscribe on a statue base. And often epigrams kind of blur the line between literature and object. So they'll make the object talk. If often, you know, it'll say, you know, like if it's a statue of a cow, oh, I'm the cow sculpted by Myron. You can practically hear me mooing, kind of thing, right? And so for the statues of Phryne or statues connected to Phryne, so there are epigrams about a statue of Eros that was given to Phryne by Praxiteles. And they love to blur the lines in that relationship between, like, who's the creator? Who's inspiring this? Is it Eros? Is it Phryne? Is Phryne the creator of the statue because she inspired Praxiteles to create this image of Eros, right? And it's this whole, just blurring of lines. There's a very famous letter, or fictional letter, I should say, written in the second century CE by a writer named Alciphron. And he's one of these writers writing in Greek under the Roman Empire. And he writes it. It's an invitation from Phryne to Praxiteles, to the sculptor, to come and make love to her beside the statue at Thespiae that he has sculpted of her, with the statues of Eros and Aphrodite there, like all watching on. Right. And she's like, you know, like, you gave this to me. It's a gift of your love, but from your love for me. And we're not doing anything wrong. We're not defiling anything by making love in a sanctuary. And I suspect that listeners of your podcast know that that's not usually a good thing to do, right?
No, like, you're
not
doing that. Bear or lion.
Yeah, don't do that in like Athena's sanctuary because you're going to end up in big trouble. But she's like, we're not defiling anything because this is like a divine love that we have. And you've created these divine images. So there's a lot of sort of melding of Phryne with Eros, Phryne with Aphrodite, blurring the lines between her and this divine sort of, it's almost like a divine trio, Phryne, Aphrodite, and Eros together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a level of irony in there that she was on trial for impiety and then this happened after the fact. Like,
yeah.
If anything sounds like impiety, it's like putting a human woman alongside Eros and Aphrodite as like, you know, I mean, even just getting her that close to them in terms of importance and beauty and everything. Like,
exactly. Or yeah, like putting an image of her at Delphi, right? If you think about, and so it's a dialogue of Plutarch's where, you know, a cynic philosopher comes along. He's like, what the heck is this doing here? This is ridiculous. Like any good cynic, right, is, I don't like anything. But the person with him is like, well, look at everything else here at Delphi. It's all been here because of war, because of terrible things that people have done. Some of it's been stolen. And that's the impiety you're worried about. That's what you find is excessive. And I really love that moment. Because it's such a great point, right? That you know, like, what is actually so terrible about having this noted woman when you would have, you could practically put up a temple to yourself, not quite a temple, but, you know, you could put up a monument to yourself right inside the most sacred sanctuaries. So why can't Phryne get some action in there? Why, you know?
Yeah.
And in the letter, I mean, literal action too, but.
I mean, of course, with a like reputation like hers, it's got to happen.
Yeah. So I think based on all of these connections to Praxiteles and the statues, I do think that at some point she and Praxiteles were connected. Mm-hmm. Did they have to have been lovers? I don't think so. That's not necessary, right? And that's a very common trope that you find. And it starts kind of with stories of people like Phryne and Praxiteles, that trope that obviously the artist and his model must also have an erotic connection too. Mm-hmm. They have to be in a relationship of some kind. And that's, you know, obviously we know that that's not necessary to create art, but it's a story that like gets told and told and told and told. And when artist models become sort of popular again, you know, especially in the 19th century, oh, those stories, they start flying around, you know, absolutely. People are telling those same exact kinds of stories. And often connected to images of Phryne, too. It goes all the way, kind of circles all the way back around again.
It makes me think, like, I often wonder about this, and I don't know anyone who reasonably couldn't, but just, like, the things that women must have talked about amongst themselves that we don't know, you know? And, like, yeah, right? Yeah.
When
it comes to someone like this, like, I just want to know what the Athenian women, well, you know, I don't mean technical Athenian women, I mean women in Athens, you know, what were they thinking and talking to each other about when this was all going on? And I just want to imagine.
Okay, so I've mentioned him already. One of my favorite authors from the ancient world is this fellow Alciphron, writing in kind of roughly the 2nd century CE, kind of end of the 2nd century. He's one of those authors writing in Greek about classical Athens under the Roman Empire, right? He's recreating it. And he is, to me, the Wes Anderson of the ancient world. Because he recreates this world in such detail, but... you know, you've seen a Wes Anderson movie. You're like, oh yeah, there's the Grand Budapest Hotel. It's set in pre-war Europe. How do I know that? Well, if I really look closely at the details, they've actually been kind of invented by Wes Anderson. So you're forced to kind of look at his artistry while you're enjoying this nostalgic image. So that's what Alciphron does. He writes fictional letters and he has 4 books of them. And the 4th book is called Letters of Hetairai. It is letters written by the Hetairai of Athens. So some of them are the famous ones like Phryne to each other about sort of their daily lives and what's going on. So there's the letter from Phryne to Praxiteles. There's a couple letters about the court case, right, of Phryne. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of the speculative way to think about like, what would these women have said to each other? What might they have talked about, right? What are they interested in? And so it's this attempt, obviously by a male author, but to kind of harness these women's voices and to think about how are these women thinking about their own lives. And that's why I love it, because of course we're in this space where we have next to no words by women themselves, right? But these are like at least purporting to be the words of these women. If I could find like a real letter written by Phryne to one of her pals, that's like a document I would give anything for.
Yeah. That makes me think, and I've not read enough of this to know kind of how it comes across, but it makes me think of Lucian, because I recently kind of did some more digging into him, and I know he had a lot of like dialogues like that. Yeah, I've still only read The True History, which is a piece of art. But yeah, now I'm interested in all the dialogues that he wrote too, mostly because of how much I love The True History.
Yeah. No, I mean, Lucian, he writes so many different kinds of things, and they're all, and it's kind of similar to what Alciphron is doing. It's stepping back into the world of classical Athens, stepping into kind of this like created nostalgic space. And of course, Lucian does it. He's a little bit more wry about it, a little bit more pointed than Alciphron is, but it's the same kind of process, and they're part of the same kind of literary trend that's happening. So please read more Lucian, because you're all going to love it. There's like, this is for everyone listening. Please read more Lucian. You're never going to be sad about it. It's amazing. But so the dialogues of the courtesans too, or that's what they're called, right? Dialogues of the Hetairai. I love them too. It's the same reason I love Greek tragedy. It's because you have, again, it's not the actual voices of women, but it's someone like representing the voice of a woman, right? And you're trying to like incorporate, just as a good playwright or a good fictional letter writer, you're actually going to have to tap into some kind of empathy for their position in society to write it in a compelling and effective way. So I'm just in love with anything like that purports to give the voice of a woman or give voice to a woman, even if it's written by a man.
I mean, we have to take what we can get, right? I mean, it's why I love Euripides so much, because to me, he's the one who actually wanted to know what women thought. And he was like, I'm going to actually examine them as real people. And like, you know, the other two playwrights they write great women. Don't get me wrong. But like, Euripides was clearly fascinated by them in a totally different way, at least in terms of what survives. Like,
yes,
it's just, it's the best.
Well, I am here to tell you also, what does not survive does the same thing, or at least the bits that we have that do survive. Yes, the fragments. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's the thing is with these women, again, I think it comes down to, you have this really constricted society for women, and the ideal for women is very, again, constricted. They don't have a lot of options. A path is very clearly laid out for them, ideally. But there are women who are not always following that path because of just life, right? Life is complicated, and it never, ideals and reality. When people depict her, and again, these are more modern depictions, but there's another painter, Boulanger, who has a painting of her kind of reclining on a bed. And she, his model, I think, was Italian. But they're using like a lot of, at that time, what are considered like Italian models, Jewish models, who are considered to be exotic at that time. Right. And so so when, you know, he exhibits this at the Academy and people look at this painting, they're like, oh, that's not what we think Frinny should look like. Right. That's, oh my goodness. And one of them calls her fat. Like, and she is just distinctly not fat. They love to do this, right? There's another painter, a Polish painter later, who paints her, and they say she looks like a man, one of the critics. It's like, so the thing about, you know, Frinny is that in the stories, in the ancient stories, she can be whatever you want her to be, whatever you think is beautiful, whatever you think is pit, whatever you can project, because she's a fragment. And then I think that's also what makes her compelling, is that because she is fragmentary, that you can do whatever you want. You can fill in the blanks however you want, that is the most pleasurable and satisfying to you. So she becomes, and I think that's something that's common with the way we tell stories about women, prominent women, even in 2023, right? That these sort of fragmentary narratives, where we don't really allow ourselves to know them deeply and meaningfully, gives us a certain kind of power over them to mold them into whatever we want them to be. And if someone presents to you a version of her or of a woman like Frinny that isn't what you thought and what you expected and what you took pleasure from, then people tend to get really defensive and angry about it too. At least these art critics, you know, the different images of her. But yeah, so the thing about Frinny is like, we don't know enough of these details to really know her. But that, I think, is another source of what has made her compelling over time.
I mean, it sounds like so much of the ancient world with just the fragmentary nature of it all, right? And like, what, that's so much more interesting than if we knew everything, like just the big open questions.
Oh, yeah. And I really think, with fragments, it allows us to think in different ways about things to kind of, we can hyper-focus on some details because that's all that we have, right? Mm-hmm. Or we can be more imaginative, and sometimes that speculation can be really generative. It can take us out of the assumptions that we've made about the ancient world as well. Yeah, I mean, obviously I love fragments. I wrote a whole dissertation about them, but it's, to me, those are some of the most compelling parts of the ancient world. And they're also, when we look closely at them, they're often the ones that contradict the dominant narratives that we have about the ancient world. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nerds, thank you all so much for listening. As always, I mentioned this, you know, in Tuesday's episode, but I really just wanted to provide you guys with a kind of refresh on this, a way of learning about these Hetairai a little bit further without having to revisit the whole episodes. But if you want to listen to those whole episodes, there's probably a good hour more on each of them if you want to check those out. So you can find those wherever you're listening to this podcast. Or else just, you know, enjoy the little extra bits of Hetairai that you've gotten today. Thank you all, as always. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the assistant producer. Laura Smith is the audio engineer and production assistant, and was so lovely as to put together these clips today. Thank you to Laura. The podcast is part of the iHeart Podcast Network. Listen on Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. If you are looking for bonus content, you can subscribe to my Patreon, where you will not only support the free show that I drown over all week and do love, but also you will have access to a load of bonus episodes from the past many, many years of putting together this Patreon. Find that at patreon.com/mythsbaby. Thank you all. You're just wonderful and lovely, and real people from the ancient world are just such an utter joy, and I can't wait to bring you more of them. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
With the new Dexcom G7, you can achieve better diabetes results without painful finger sticks. It sends your glucose numbers to your compatible phone or watch, so you can always see where you are and where you're heading. See how food and exercise affects your glucose, making it easier to spend more time in range and lower your A1C. Take control of your diabetes with the number one recommended CGM brand. It's easy to get started today at Dexcom.com. That's Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom. Dexcom.com/compatibility.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
When it comes to your job, you're likely well-versed, but what about your skin? Life's busy enough. It doesn't have to be a big chore to get well-versed skin. Check out the dermatologist-tested, cruelty-free vegan skincare products from Verst. It's under $25 and available at your local Target store, making it easier than ever to take care of your skin from head to toe. Podcast listeners, here's an exclusive deal. 15% off at VERSEDskin.com with code MEDIA15. That's VERSEDskin.com with code MEDIA15. Verst, available at Target.